I want to thank each of you for coming out on such a nice morning. What was balmy has turned into blustery, and I hope I'm not either one. But I'll do my best. Terry asked me a year ago to do this assignment, and I have been collecting items from newspapers and the internet and other sources ever since he assigned this to me last May out at Pepperdine, asleep at the switch while Muslims invade. So I'll be sharing some of this, some of these documents with you that I've actually formed quite a dossier. I don't have this ready to put up on my website yet, but hopefully later in April it'll be up on the website. So if you want to take notes, feel free to. And if you want to wait till it goes up on the website, that would be fine, because there's a lot of information that I'm going to be sharing with you. I brought along with me a little book that's now in its fifth printing called The Biblical Roots of Islam. There's a few up here on the stage if you want to look through them. At my booth, One Body Magazine, I don't sell, I just give things away, but College Press is handling this. There, some of my books are at other places here, but this one is exclusively at College Press. So when you leave here, if you want to pick one up over there, or if you want to look at some of these on the stage, I brought half a dozen copies with me to see if it's worth the $5. It's a big, big, high-priced book. But we have revised and expanded it, and we now have 30 discussion questions in it, so it's good for small groups. It's just a little primer, Cliff's Notes on the Biblical Roots of Islam, you could call it. And I'll be reading from it a little bit at the beginning, and if we have time, at the ending again today. I want to start by sharing a passage of Scripture from the Gospel of Matthew, the 13th chapter, which you will immediately recognize as the parables of the sower and the seed. But I just want to look at two verses in the New King James Version translation, verses 24 and 25, and you see if these are not appropriate for the text that's been assigned on being asleep at the switch. Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way." You see, terrible things can happen while men are sleeping. Just ask the survivors of Pearl Harbor. Looking out on this audience, I wouldn't be surprised if we have one or two of them with us today. But when an entire nation goes to sleep, everyone is in peril. Few can remember the evening of September 10th, 2001, but everyone knows where they were and what they were doing and what they were thinking the day after, September 11th, 2001. This title that Terry assigned me, Asleep at the Switch, is a phrase that goes back to 19th century railroading, when it was a trainsman's duty to switch the railroad cars from one track to the other by means of manually operated levers. If the trainman was asleep at the switch, literally, disaster could and often did take place. Trains could collide. People's lives were lost. Later, this phrase, asleep at the switch, came to mean anyone's lack of alertness and or failure to take one's responsibility seriously. It's my conviction that Christianity is on a collision course with Islam, the world's fastest growing religion. While men sleep, the enemy is sowing weeds among the wheat. And I'm talking from Congress to the church. Men and women are asleep at the switch, and all the while, the enemy is sowing weeds among the wheat. Indeed, in many places, the weeds are now overtaking the wheat. I want to read just a few paragraphs from the introduction to my book on the biblical roots of Islam. At 8:46 a.m. on September 11, 2001, an American Airlines Boeing 767 hijacked by 9/11 mastermind Mohammed Atta slammed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City. And from that fateful moment on, there has been an urgent and almost frantic interest in the religion of Islam. 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, a Muslim nation. There are 1.84 billion Muslims in the world today. That's about 27% of the world's population. That means that 1.37 out of every four persons on earth is a follower of Muhammad. Radical Shiite Muslims, those who take jihad or holy war very seriously and literally, account for only 10% of the population of the world's Muslims. Still, that amounts to 184 million people, some of whom would gladly die as martyrs for their cause, as they did on September 11th. Estimates of Muslims living in America are hard to reach because the U.S. Census no longer allows the inquirers to ask about their religion, but the estimates range from 2 million to 8 million. There are now about 3,000 mosques in the United States. In 1990, there were only 30. An average of one new mosque is being built each week in a city in America. So if indeed you take 8 million Muslims living in America, they would outrank every religious group except three: Roman Catholics, Southern Baptists, and United Methodists. There are more Muslims in America today than there are Lutherans, or Mormons, or Presbyterians, or the Assemblies of God, or Episcopalians, or Pentecostals, or Churches of Christ, or the Fellowship of Christian Churches and Churches of Christ, just to name a few of the top 25 churches listed in the annual yearbook of American and Canadian churches. 30 years ago, in Christianity Today, George Fry wrote an article called Christianity's Greatest Challenge. This was 30 years ago. He said, first, theologically, Islam is Christianity's chief rival for the loyalty of mankind, the only universal faith that claims to have surpassed or superseded Christianity. Secondly, historically, next to Judaism, Islam is Christians' oldest competitor, the only world religion to win great number of converts from Christianity. And incidentally, after 9/11, converts to Islam in America skyrocketed. You'd think it would have went the other way, wouldn't you? Third, practically, Islam is Christianity's greatest missionary competitor, Christianity's major rival today for the allegiance of people. Those were words spoken 30 years ago in Christianity Today, which is the main organ of evangelical Christianity. I would God that we had listened to George Fry and taken him seriously then. But that was then, and this is now, and nothing has changed, and yet everything has changed. Islam remains Christianity's chief rival and competitor for the hearts and souls of mankind. Saudi Arabia has channeled billions of dollars to spread the religion of Islam in the United States since 1987. Muslim countries like Iraq, Libya, and Kuwait have done the same. Muslims are now the second largest religious group in France, and the church building where William Carey was sent from England to India as a missionary is now a mosque. And there are more Muslims in England today than there are Baptists and Methodists. That's from the introduction of the book, The Biblical Roots of Islam. Now, what I did when Terry assigned me this, I just started keeping my eyes and ears open, and I collected these following things that I'm going to be sharing with you. The first is from the blog of Albert Moeller, Southern Baptist, and you can go to it, albertmoeller.com. It feels as if the soul of Britain is dying. So we're going to start in Europe and see, while men have been asleep at the switch, how Muslims have invaded that great missionary-sending country of Great Britain. He quotes from Callum Brown's book, The Death of Christian Britain, and he says, "It took but several centuries to convert Britain to Christianity, but it has taken less than 40 years for the country to forsake it. In unprecedented numbers, the British people since the 1960s have stopped going to church, have allowed their church membership to lapse, have stopped marrying in church, have neglected to baptize their children. Meanwhile, their children, the two generations who grew to maturity in the last 30 years of the 20th century, stopped going to Sunday school, and Britain was the birthplace of the Sunday school with Robert Raikes, stopped entering confirmation or communicant classes, and rarely, if ever, stepped inside a church to worship in their entire lives. The cycle of intergenerational renewal of Christian affiliation, a cycle which had for so many centuries tied the people, however closely or loosely, to the churches and to Christian moral benchmarks, was permanently disrupted in the swinging 60s. That's when I grew up. That's when I went to Bible college. Since then, a formerly religious people have entirely forsaken organized Christianity in a sudden plunge into a truly secular condition." And then he quotes Ruth Gledel, writing in the London Times, "Church attendance in Britain is declining so fast that the number of religious churchgoers will be fewer than those attending mosques within a generation. This fall means that the Church of England, or the Anglican Church, Catholicism, and other denominations will become financially unviable. A lack of funds. Now think of all the money that Saudi Arabia is pumping in, billions and billions of dollars. But all of these churches in England will soon, within a generation, she predicts, become financially unviable. A lack of funds from the collection plate to support the Christian infrastructure, including church upkeep and ministers' pay, will force church closures as aging congregations die. In contrast, the number of actively religious Muslims will have increased from 1 million today to nearly 2 million in 2035. That's not that far away. By these projections, attendance in Christian churches will drop to just 350,000 by the year 2030. They will be spread among 10,000 churches, each with an average worship attendance of only 35 people. And most of those will be old people. The Church of England will then lose all institutional viability. By then, Christianity will have become a minority religion in the United Kingdom, with Muslims far outnumbering active Christians. The same projections indicate that even Hindus in Great Britain will come close to outnumbering active Christians. There is something unbearably sad about the plight of Christianity in this country," she said. "It feels as if the soul of Britain is dying." And then Moeller comments, "Britain's loss of faith is not a new phenomenon, But it is now reaching, listen, terminal stages. The secularization of British society will bring a radical transformation of the culture. The nation will be fundamentally redefined when Muslims outnumber practicing Christians 3-1. And if you followed British Parliament at all, you know that they are being elected one after another into the Parliament now in England. British Christianity was for centuries a spiritual force that changed the world, changed our nation. The modern missionary movement began with William Carey, who left England for India in order to share the gospel of Christ. And as I said, the church where he was sent from is now a mosque. The movement to end the slave trade can be traced to William Wilberforce and his successful pleas to Britain's Parliament. The Methodists, the Baptists, and any number of other denominational groups emerged out of British Christianity. The Church of England gave birth to a worldwide communion of Anglican churches. Quite soon, all that may just be a series of footnotes in British history books. The secularization of Britain is not something forced upon the nation, but something the nation has done to itself. Now, America had better sit up and take notice, because what happens in the United Kingdom eventually comes to the United States. Anyone remember the British invasion? We're talking about what happens when Muslims invade a nation, and then others and others. In Europe today, finally, some Europeans are concerned about the Muslim takeover in countries like France and Spain. The latest dispute is in Switzerland, which is planning a nationwide referendum to ban minarets on mosques. These are sometimes six stories tall, sometimes even greater than some of the great Gothic cathedrals in Europe. This month, Italy's interior minister vowed to close a controversial mosque in Milan. And I just want to interject here that when I was in Beslan, Russia, several years ago to minister to the victims of that terrible school slaughter, the mosque in the center of Beslan had to be shut down by the Russian government because that's where all of these Chechenian terrorists stash their cache of weapons to attack those schools, was in a mosque right there in Beslan, Russia. Some analysts call the mosque conflicts the manifestation of a growing fear that Muslims aren't assimilating, don't accept Western values, and pose a threat to security. It takes this long for them to find that out, is my question. But the media still calls this Islamophobia, that Europeans are just feeling threatened by their Muslim neighbors. There are an estimated 18 million Muslims who constitute the continent's second biggest religion. Living amid Western Europeans' predominantly Christian population, and you have to take that at face value, of 400 million people. This is a turnaround from the 1980s and the 1990s, when construction of large mosques was accepted by those in Europe and even celebrated in many cities by Christians, thinking, oh, isn't this so nice? We can live in peace and harmony with our religious neighbors. But now they are having second thoughts. We already have more than 6,000 mosques in Europe, which are not only a place to worship, but are also a symbol of radicalization, some financed by extreme groups out of Saudi Arabia, said a leader of the Flemish Separatist Party in Belgium. Construction of a new mosque in Cologne, Germany, has drawn protests from residents and sparked a political debate in Berlin over concerns that it could overshadow the city's great Gothic cathedral. In London, plans for a mega mosque for 12,000 worshipers next to the site of the 2012 Olympics drew 250,000 plus opposing signatures. And this is from the international director of the Center for Islamic Pluralism in London. He admitted, truthfully speaking, and I'm quoting, "We don't need so many mosques. We have 1,600 mosques in Britain and a Muslim population of 1.6 million. It's become a business rather than a worship place." At the United Nations on November 24th last year, a coalition of Muslim countries voted as a bloc. This would be the Arab League of Nations, 22 strong, to pass a draft proposal that prohibits defamation of religions. But of course, they only have one religion in mind. They understand this to mean that no one will be allowed to criticize Islam. And if passed by the United Nations, this resolution will definitely undermine standards codified in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and will become a legal impediment to Christian evangelism. France has reportedly cut off internet access to any known sites that criticize Muslim teachings. And in Finland, a blogger has been jailed for 2.5 years for so-called attacks on Islam. And we need to be praying that European officials will distinguish between objective analysis of Islam, appropriate freedom of speech, and advocating violence or civil unrest. Let's go to our neighbors to the north, Canada. Although only 2% of its citizens are Muslims, did you know that Islam is Canada's fastest growing religion? Between 1991 and 2001, the number of Muslims doubled to an estimated 580,000. Last December, Canadians were horrified by news of the honor killing of a 16-year-old Islamic girl by her Muslim father in the city of Mississauga, Ontario. That really caught my attention because I've served on the board of Global Missionary Missions, which is located right in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. Her close friends say she was murdered because of her refusal to wear the hijab, or the head covering. In very strict Muslim communities, a woman whose hair or face is uncovered is viewed as immoral and deserving of death for the sake of her family's honor. Harsh subordination of women is a major tenet of classical Islam, and wife beating is actually recommended in the Quran. So here, to our neighbors to the north, in Canada, a father, a Muslim father, kills his 16-year-old daughter for failure to wear the head covering and is not prosecuted by the Canadian government. Well, let's come down to the own United States of America. This was from USA Today, the online edition, headline, "Obama, America is no longer Christian. Democrat says nation also for Muslims and non-believers." Whatever we once were, we're no longer a Christian nation. I'm quoting now not the former senator of Illinois, but of course the president of the United States. Whatever we once were, we're no longer a Christian nation, at least not just. We are also a Jewish nation, a Muslim nation, a Buddhist nation, a Hindu nation, and a nation of unbelievers. At this speech, which was delivered in June 2007, Obama also blasted the Christian right for hijacking religion and using it to divide the nation. And I quote, somehow, somewhere along the way, faith stopped being used to bring us together and started being used to drive us apart. It got hijacked. Interesting that he would use that word. Part of it's because of the so-called leaders of the Christian right who've been all too eager to exploit what divides us. And then, when asked to clarify his remarks on CBN, the Christian Broadcast Network, he did so. And I quote, "I think that the right might worry a bit more about the dangers of sectarianism. Whatever we once were, we're no longer just a Christian nation. We are also a Jewish nation, a Muslim nation, a Buddhist nation, a Hindu nation, and a nation of unbelievers. I'm going to have to skip over some of this material because of my time. But I do want to mention Dr. Herbert London, who is the author of a new book, America's Secular Challenge, The Rise of a New National Religion. And you can go to his website, herblondon.org, to find this material. But he is the president of the Hudson Institute, one of the oldest and most respected think tanks in the world. Listen how he describes Islam's agenda. It is, quote, to destroy Israel, create a Middle East devoid of any religion but Islam, employ the oil empire to create caliphates from Madrid to Jakarta, and then launch a holy war against the West. That, says London, is the defining test of our age, and he wonders and worries whether the West will find the moral strength to defend its core values. On the blatant bias in media and academia, Dr. London laments, it is not bias that is so deplorable. It is the transformation of bias into an orthodoxy that cannot countenance another point of view. Western Judeo-Christian culture is ashamed of itself and in retreat, says Dr. London, adding, secularists would probably bash Islam too if it were not so quick to react with a violent defense. The book urges American secularists to realize that Islam's evil is real, that it is far more oppressive than anything Americans have to offer, and that it threatens us now. I believe we still command the resources to salvage the spiritual center of our civilization, he said, but to accomplish this, we must have the courage to challenge the seductive tenets of radical secularism and revive the traditional values that informed and once nourished America. Some of you have seen Brigitte Gabriel on some of the television talk shows. She began her career as a news anchor for World News on an evening Arabic news broadcast for Middle East television that was seen throughout Israel, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Cyprus, and Lebanon. She is from Lebanon, and she immigrated to America in the late 80s. This is taken from one of her communiques, the handwriting on the wall. She said, I have been declaring to anyone who would listen that Islamicists are well on their way to subverting and transforming Europe. We've already seen that. And they are riding that wave here to America. I have told my personal story of how Islamists step by step took over my country of Lebanon, how they used our freedoms and commitment to tolerance and multiculturalism against us to further their ultimate ends. And now, she says, they are using the same strategies and tactics against us in the West. In recent weeks, we have seen a violent Islamic protest in Britain where an angry mob shouting Allahu Akbar, yes, chased dozens of British policemen for blocks. You must see the video to believe it, and she gives the video site. Pro-Hamas, anti-Israel Muslims conducting demonstrations here in America shouted praises to Hitler for what he did to the Jews, yelling, go back to the ovens, and at times physically attacking counter-protesters. She cites Austrian parliamentarian Suzanne Winter, who was convicted of incitement because of public statements she has boldly made, including the claims that the Prophet Muhammad was a pedophile. The release of a U.S. official government report, I saw this just last week on TV, stating that Hezbollah is forming terrorist cells here in the United States that are now operational. And I think the website I saw this listed 30 or 35, 39, somewhere in the 30s that are now going on right here in America. She says, my friends, the handwriting clearly is on the wall. Radical Islam is on the march. It is growing stronger and bolder each passing day. What elected official in Europe or the UK will now have the courage to speak out against this threat? How many more no-go zones, which are Muslim enclaves where non-Muslims and even police officers fear to go in France, will now appear throughout Europe? What will happen in America when 50,000 ranting, chanting Islamist demonstrators attempt to aggressively back down and chase police officers who are trying to maintain order? And if the police do back down and run, as they did in Britain, what message is being sent to these people? In Jerusalem, this is from Turkish World Outreach, one of my best sources of what's happening in the world of Islam today in Turkey. In Jerusalem, the Muslim Dome of the Rock stands on the Temple Mount, which is sacred, of course, to both Jews and Christians. It was built in the late 7th century and is in the style of the early Christian churches. The inscriptions on the wall read, "He is God. He has no companion. He does not beget. He is not begotten." The Caliph Omar, who erected this structure, was in effect saying to all Christendom, "Your religion is superseded. Your time has passed. We are taking over the world." And if you know anything at all about church history, you understand this is the classic stance of Islam and continues to captivate and incite millions of Muslims today. In North America, we normally think of the collapse of the Soviet Union as a Western victory in the Cold War. But Osama bin Laden and his followers claim it as a Muslim triumph, and here is how they reason. The Taliban in Afghanistan drove the Red Army to defeat. As bin Laden put it, we have now dealt successfully with the more deadly and the more dangerous of the two infidel powers, dealing with the soft, pampered, degenerate America will be easy. So he says that the collapse of the Soviet Union was due to the Muslim Afghan army driving out the Soviets, and that an easier target will be the soft, pampered, degenerate America. Muslim militants refer to the United States as the Great Satan and are eagerly plotting our nation's destruction. Many Americans are awakening to this threat in spite of deluded attempts by politicians and many in the media to portray Islam as, quote, a religion of peace, end quote. Such depictions are based on wishful thinking and certainly not on past history or present reality. In 2006, Keith Ellison from the state of Minnesota became our first nation's Muslim congressman. In taking the oath of office, he placed his hand not on a Bible, but on the Quran. His swearing-in ceremony received the most media attention of any event in the history of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, here's what you don't know about that story, perhaps. The Quran that Ellison used as a prop had belonged to Thomas Jefferson, one of our nation's founding fathers, third president of the United States. It was borrowed from the rare book section of the Library of Congress. And Ellison said he chose this particular Quran that Thomas Jefferson had once owned because it shows, and I quote his words, "A visionary like Jefferson had gleaned wisdom from many sources." Congressman Ellison obviously didn't know why Thomas Jefferson had obtained a copy of the Quran, and that was to understand the mindset of Muslim enemies of the United States. And here's the story. When the American colonists rebelled against Great Britain, their merchant ships lost the protection of the British Royal Navy. Without this protection, American ships in the Mediterranean were vulnerable to attacks by Muslim pirates of the slave-trading Barbary states of North Africa. And as a result, crews and passengers of American vessels were sold into slavery. Americans captured, sold into slavery. Captured boys and young men were castrated because eunuchs brought higher prices in the Ottoman slave markets. The Muslim slavers especially prized Christian women for the high price they brought as concubines or slave wives. Islamic law allows Muslim men to take as many as four wives at a time and to have as many concubines as their fortunes allow. In 1784, the Continental Congress chose to negotiate treaties with the Barbary States and to appease the slave traders by paying tribute and ransom in order to retrieve ships and buy the freedom of enslaved Americans. Thomas Jefferson, our third president, was opposed to this decision and believed that the matter should be settled through the medium of war and not negotiation. In 1786, America's ambassadors to France and Great Britain, and that would be Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, met in London with the Barbary Coast ambassador to Britain. During the meeting, they asked why Muslims had such hostility toward America. They reported to Congress that Ambassador Haji Abdul Rahman Aja said Islam was founded on the laws of their prophet, that according to the Quran, all nations that did not acknowledge their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war on such peoples and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Muslim slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. In the following 15 years, the United States paid the Muslims millions of dollars for the safe passage of American ships and the return of enslaved Americans. In 1800, the payments amounted to one-fifth of the annual revenues of the United States government. Shortly after his inauguration as president in 1801, Thomas Jefferson deployed American Marines and many of the country's best warships to the Mediterranean in the United States' first military action overseas. He declared that during his watch as president of the United States, America was going to spend millions on defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. In 1805, U.S. Marines marched from Egypt to Tripoli and forced the city's surrender and the freeing of American slaves. The last of the Muslim pirates were defeated in 1815. Following intense naval bombardments and coastal raids by the U.S. Marines, the Barbary States agreed to abandon slavery and piracy altogether. Amazing as it may seem, the U.S. ended slavery on the shores of North Africa a half century before doing so on its own soil. Following its independence, our nation's first military conflict was with Muslim states. Islam has not changed, and the lessons of that conflict should not be forgotten. As important as military strength is, the greatest defense for the United States and the Western world is not in our armaments, but in the proclamation of the gospel. Now, I share that story with you because Ellison made a great deal of this, of putting his hand on the Quran that Thomas Jefferson had once used to show how that Jefferson believed in diversity and peace with religious neighbors. The reason he got that Quran was so he could understand the mindset of the Barbary pirates and go to war with them and defeat them. That's why he had the Quran. Very quickly, this is adopted from Dr. Peter Hammett's book, Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam. You can find this on frontline.org, The Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat. This is how Islam works. It isn't just a religion. In its fullest form, in its complete, total, 100% system of life, Islamization begins when there are sufficient Muslims in a country to agitate for their religious rights. When politically correct, tolerant, and culturally diverse societies agree to Muslim demands for their religious rights, some of the other components tend to creep in as well. And this, he says, is happening now, where 2% or less of the public are Muslim, such as the United States, Australia, Canada, Italy, and Norway. From 2 to 5%, then, he says, it ratchets up. They begin proselyting other ethnic minorities and disaffected groups, often major recruiting from among street gangs. And he says this is happening in Denmark, Germany, and the UK and Spain. From 5% on, they exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to the percentage of the population. They push for the introduction of halal food, which means clean by Islamic standards, thereby securing food preparation jobs for Muslims. This increases pressure on supermarket chains to feature halal on their shelves. France, the Philippines, Sweden, Switzerland, the Netherlands, even Trinidad and Tobago. So forth and so on, and it ratchets up until you get to 40%, where you start having chronic terror attacks, ongoing militia warfare, such as in Bosnia, Chad, and Lebanon. Then from 60% on, how it just gets worse and worse, Albania, Malaysia, Qatar, Sudan, so forth. And then 100%, and these would be nations like Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, where my sister lived for 7 years, Somalia, and Yemen, which ushers in supposedly the peace of Dar es Salaam, the Islamic House of Peace. Here there's supposed to be peace because everyone is a Muslim. The madrasas are the only schools. The Quran is the only word. And he quotes, I don't know if any of you have read any of Leon Uris' works, The Hajj. He says, speaking of a young character in the book, "Before I was 9, I had learned the basic canon of Arab life. It was me against my brother, me and my brother against our father, my family against my cousins in the clan against the tribe against the world, and all of us against the infidel." Today's 1.5 billion Muslims make up 22% of the world's population. This is outdated. It's now 27%. But their birth rates dwarf the birth rate of Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, and Jews, and all other believers. By the end of this century, Muslims will exceed 50% of the world's population. Look out, world, then. I wish I had time to read this prayer that the Voice of the Martyrs puts out. They have a booth here, maybe they have this, of a young girl who wrote her testimony to Christ just before her own family put her to death. At the conclusion of this little book that I wrote on the biblical roots of Islam, I have three chapters that offer hope. One is called Glimmers of Hope. The second is called Prophetic Fulfillment. And the third is called Christianity's Greatest Challenge. When I go back to that Christianity Today article that was issued 30 years ago that we should have listened to, it might not be too late. I don't know. But I hope that the three closing chapters of this book will show you that there is hope. And that hope is in the Middle East's most famous son, Jesus Christ. That's the world's only hope, that Christians learn how to communicate with reasoning Muslims and hope that they will have an influence on the unreasoning Muslims. Jesus Christ is the only hope. This is the book. I've got a few copies up here if you want to look at it. It's $5 at College Press. I'll get back there as soon as I can, and if the weather breaks, let's bow for prayer. Father, we thank you. We thank you so much for your son, Jesus Christ. And even though we live in times when men are asleep at the switch and Muslims are invading nation after nation with a well-orchestrated plan, we pray that we would be more committed than ever to the gospel of Jesus Christ and would speak the truth in love, that we might win these dear people to you for your cause and bring them from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. Thank you for each one who is here today. May you bless them. In Jesus' name, amen.